Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Well, good afternoon. We are getting started with our discussion. We're going to be going over the Torah portion called the Shalach, not Shalach. That's a different sort of thing. Over Numbers 13 through 15. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Send out for yourself men so that they may spy out the land of Canaan, which I am going to give to the sons of Israel. You shall send a man from each of their father's tribes, each one a leader among them." So Moshe sent them from the wilderness of Paran on the command of the Lord, all of them men who were heads of the sons of Israel. These then were their names: from the tribe of Reuben, Shema, the son of Zakur; from the tribe of Shimon, Shaphat, the son of Hori; from the tribe of Yehuda, Caleb, the son of Jephunneh; from the tribe of Issachar, Igal, the son of Yosef; from the tribe of Ephraim, Hoshea, the son of Nun; from the tribe of Benjamin, Palti, the son of Raphu; from the tribe of Zebulun, Gadiel, the son of Sodi; and from the tribe of Yosef, from the tribe of Manasseh, Gadi, the son of Susi; from the tribe of Dan, Amiel, the son of Gamali; from the tribe of Asher, Setur, the son of Michael; from the tribe of Naphtali, Nachbi, the son of Vofsi; from the tribe of Gad, Geuel, the son of Machi. These are the names of the men whom Moshe sent to spy out the land. But Moshe called Hoshea, the son of Nun, Yehoshua. When Moshe sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, he said to them, "Go up there into the Negev, then go up into the hill country. See what the land is like and whether the people who live in it are strong or weak, whether they are few or many. How is the land in which they live? Is it good or bad? And how are the cities in which they live? Are they like open camps or with fortifications? How is the land? Is it fat or lean? Are there trees in it or not? Make an effort then to get some of the fruit of the land." Now the time was the time of the first ripe grapes. So they went up and spied out the land from the wilderness of Zin as far as Rehob at Libo Hamat. When they had gone up into the Negev, they came to Hebron, where Ahiman, Sheshai, and Talmai, the descendants of Anak, were there. Now Hebron was built 7 years before Zoan in Mitzrayim. Then they came to the valley of Eshkol, and from there cut down a branch with a single cluster of grapes, and they carried it on a pole between two men, with some of the pomegranates and the figs. The place they called the valley of Eshkol because of the cluster which the sons of Israel cut down from there. When they returned from spying out the land at the end of 40 days, they proceeded to come to Moshe and Aharon and to all the congregation of the sons of Israel in the wilderness of Paran at Kadesh. And they brought back word to them and to all the congregation and showed them the fruit of the land. Thus they told them and said, "We went into the land where you sent us, and certainly it does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. Nevertheless, the people who live in the land are strong, and the cities are fortified and very large. And moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. Amalek is living in the land of the Negev, and Hittites and the Jebusites, and the Amorites are living in the hill country, and the Canaanites are living by the sea and by the side of the Yarden." Then Caleb quieted the people before Moshe and said, "We should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it." But the men who had gone up with him said, "We are not able to go up against the people. They are far too strong for us." So they gave out. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report of the land which they had spied out, saying, "The land through which we have gone and spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. There we also saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who are part of the Nephilim. And we became like grasshoppers in our sight, so we were in their sight." Chapter 14. When all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night, all the sons of Israel grumbled against Moshe and Aharon, and the whole congregation said to them, "Would that we had died in the land of Mitzrayim, or we would have died in the wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us to this land? To fall by the sword? Our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Mitzrayim?" So they said to one another, "Let us appoint a leader and return to Mitzrayim." Then Moshe and Aharon fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly in the congregation of the sons of Israel. Yehoshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, of those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the sons of Israel, saying, "The land which we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord is pleased with us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, and do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." But all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Then the glory of the Lord appeared in the tent of meeting, and to all the sons of Israel. The Lord said to Moshe, "How long will this people spurn me? How long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst? I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they." But Moshe said to the Lord, "Then the people of Mitzrayim will hear of it, for by your strength you brought up this people from their midst, and they will tell it to the inhabitants of this land. They have heard that you, O Lord, are in the midst of this people, for you, O Lord, are seen eye to eye while your cloud stands over them. And you will go before them in a cloud, a pillar of cloud by day, and in a pillar of fire by night. So if you slay this people as one man, then the nations who have heard of your fame will say, 'Because the Lord could not bring this people into the land which he promised them by oath, therefore he slaughtered them in the wilderness.' But now I pray, let the power of the Lord be great, just as you have declared. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. But he will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and the fourth generations. Pardon, I pray, the iniquity of this people according to the greatness of your loving kindness, just as you have forgiven this people from Mitzrayim even until now." So the Lord said, "I have pardoned them according to your word. But indeed, as I live, all the earth will be filled with the glory of the Lord. Surely all the men who have seen my glory, my signs which I performed in Mitzrayim and in the wilderness, yet have put me to the test these 10 times and have not listened to my voice, shall by no means see the land which I swore to their fathers, nor shall any of those who spurned me see it. But my servant Caleb, because he has a different spirit and has followed me fully, I will bring into the land which he entered, and his descendants shall take possession of it. Now the Amalekites and the Canaanites live in the valleys. Turn tomorrow and set out to the wilderness by the way of the Red Sea." The Lord spoke to Moshe and Aharon, saying, "How long shall I bear with this evil generation? who are grumbling against me. I have heard the complaints of the sons of Israel, which they are making against me. Say to them, as I live, says the Lord, just as you have spoken in my hearing, so I will surely do to you. Your corpses will fall in the wilderness, even in all your numbered men. According to your complete number, from 20 years old and upward, who have grumbled against me. Surely you shall not come into the land which I swore to settle you, except Caleb the son of Jephunneh and Yehoshua the son of Nun. Your children, however, whom you would have become prey, I will bring them in, and they will know that the land which you have rejected. But as for you, your corpses will fall in the wilderness. Your sons shall be shepherds for 40 years in the wilderness, and they will suffer for your unfaithfulness until your corpses lie in the desert. According to the number of days which you spied out the land, 40 days. For every day you shall bear your guilt a year, even 40 years, and you will know my opposition. I, the Lord, have spoken. Surely this I will do to all this evil congregation who have gathered together against me. In this wilderness they shall be destroyed, and there they will die. As for the men whom Moshe sent out to spy out the land, and who returned and made all the congregation grumble against him by bringing out a bad report in the land, even those men who brought out the very bad report of the land died by a plague before the Lord. But Yehoshua, the son of Nun, and Caleb, the son of Jephunneh, remained alive out of the men who went out to spy out the land. When Moshe spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, the people mourned greatly. But in the morning, however, they rose up early and went up to the ridge of the hill country, saying, "Here we are. We have indeed sinned, but we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised." But Moshe said, "Why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed? Do not go up, or you will be struck down before your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. For the Amalekites and the Canaanites will be there in front of you, and you will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned back from following the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you." But they went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moshe left the camp. Then the Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. Chapter 15. Now the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, "Speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land where you are to live, which I am giving you, then make an offering by fire to the Lord, a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow, or as a freewill offering, or in your appointed times, to make a soothing aroma to the Lord, from the herd or from the flock. The one who presents his offering shall present to the Lord a grain offering of 1/10 of an ephah of fine flour, mixed with 1/4 of a hin of oil. And you shall prepare wine for the drink offering, 1/4 of a hin, with the burnt offering and for the sacrifice for each lamb. Or for a ram you shall prepare a grain offering, 2/10 of an ephah, fine flour mixed with 1/3 of a hin of oil. And for the drink offering you shall offer 1/3 of a hin of wine as a soothing aroma to the Lord. When you prepare a bull as a burnt offering or a sacrifice to fulfill a special vow, or for a peace offering to the Lord, then you shall offer with the bull a grain offering of 3/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with 1/2 a hin of oil. And you shall offer as the drink offering 1/2 of a hin of wine as an offering by fire, as a soothing aroma to the Lord. Thus it shall be done for each ox, or for each ram, or for each of the male lambs or of the goats. According to the number that you prepare, so you shall do for everyone according to their number. All who are native shall do these things in this matter, in presenting an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord. If an alien sojourns among you, or one who may be among you throughout your generations, and he wishes to make an offering by fire as a soothing aroma to the Lord, just as you do, so he shall do. As for the assembly, there shall be one statute for you, and for the alien who sojourns with you, a perpetual statute throughout your generations. As you are, so shall the alien be before the Lord. There is to be one law and one ordinance for you and for the alien who sojourns among you. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land where I bring you, then it shall be when you eat of the food of the land, you shall lift up an offering to the Lord. Of the first of your dough, you shall lift up a cake as an offering, as the offering of the threshing floor, so you shall lift it up. For the first of your dough you shall give to the Lord an offering throughout your generations. But when you unwittingly fail and do not observe all these commandments which the Lord your God has spoken to Moshe, even all that the Lord has commanded you through Moshe, from the day when the Lord gave commandment and onward throughout your generations, then it shall be, if it is done unintentionally, without the knowledge of the congregation, then all the congregation shall offer one bull for a burnt offering, for a soothing aroma as to the Lord, with its grain offering and its drink offering, according to the ordinance, one male goat for a sin offering. Then the priest shall make atonement for all the congregation of the sons of Israel, and they will be forgiven, for it was an error, and they have brought their offering, an offering by fire to the Lord, and their sin offering before the Lord for their error. So all the congregation of the sons of Israel will be forgiven with the alien who sojourns among them, for it happened to all the people through error. Also, if one sins unintentionally, then he shall offer a one-year-old female goat for a sin offering. The priest shall make atonement before the Lord for the person who goes astray when he sins unintentionally, making atonement for him that he may be forgiven. You shall have one law for him who does anything unintentionally, for him who is native among the sons of Israel, and for the alien who sojourns among them. But the person who does anything defiantly, whether he is native or an alien, that one is blaspheming the Lord, and that person shall be cut off from among his people. Because he has despised the word of the Lord and has broken his commandment, that person shall be completely cut off. His guilt will be on him. Now while the sons of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man gathering wood on the Shabbat. Those who found him gathering wood brought him to Moshe and Aharon and to all the congregation. And they put him in custody because it had not been declared what shall be done to him. Then the Lord spoke to Moshe, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside the camp. So all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, just as the Lord had commanded Moshe. The Lord also spoke to Moshe, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and tell them that they shall make for themselves tzitzit on the corners of their garments throughout their generations, and that they shall put on the tzitzit of each corner a cord of blue. It shall be a tassel for you to look at and remember all the commandments of the Lord, so as to do them and not to follow after your own heart or after your own eyes, after which you played the harlot, so that you may remember to do all my commandments and be holy to your God. I am the Lord your God who brought you out from the land of Mitzrayim to be your God. I am the Lord your God. So that is the reading that we are taking a look at here today. Before we get going too much further, and any questions or observations, we have a question over here. So what was that? Hold on just a moment.
I just wanted to talk about chapter 14,
chapter 14,
34.
Chapter 14, verse 34.
According to the number of the days in which you spied out the land, 40 days for each day you shall bear your guilt, 1 year. namely 40 years, and you shall know my rejection. I've never seen that before, that verse. It's very interesting.
So now you know why they were going out there for 40 years.
Yeah.
Because of the 40 days.
Wow. Okay. Now, what's a heave offering and what's a wave offering?
The heave and the wave offering.
One is it? Is one a dedication?
Well, one of these things is, you know, you're about presenting things before the Lord. Now, we're going to get to it, but the reason why you see these offerings here and why you see the note there about the tassels or the tzitzit tote there in chapter 15 is not random. It has everything to do with what happened in the previous two chapters. So, remember what we were talking about throughout through the book of Vayikra or Leviticus, what the whole purpose of the korbanot is all about. Korban means the thing that approaches. So it's about getting close to God and what the lesson of the whole tabernacle, the parable of the tabernacle, is all about. So kind of keep that in mind as we get forward into chapter 15. Any other observations or questions before we get going? Things that are waved before the Lord. We're going to get to those in talking about why these particular things are offered. And you'll note, just a little preview of coming attractions, two key words in chapter 15. Unintentional and defiant. Those are two key words to understand why chapter 15 is there. So, any other thoughts before we get going? Yes, we have a question down here in the front. Yes. Well, the thing is, you know, just need to be able to hear. They got what they wished for. What did they wish for?
They wanted to die in the wilderness.
Oh, they wanted to die. Well, yeah, they thought that's what the whole plan was, to die in the wilderness. Well, I guess you'd say self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah. Yes, we have another question over here.
Question, but I was thinking, can you imagine watching the plague hit all of those guys who spied out the land? Is that what happened? Like the plague just came on and bam, except for the two that had a good report. And then I was thinking also that they didn't trust God to protect their children. And he's like, you know what? Your kids are going to survive this and you're not.
So you think you're protecting them. They didn't have faith. That's actually one of the big subtexts in there about having faith, having trust in the one who brought you. Yeah, faith is, you know, I guess you could say a better way to define faith, what we commonly call faith, is trust. Because, you know, in the epistle of James, it brings that into sharp focus about those people who might think, you know, in Greek it's translated, you know, pistbut what you would call faith, really you have to think of as trust. Because if you do not trust, then, you know, it's not just pure knowledge, because as the apostle points out, it's like, hey, demons, they have better knowledge than you do about what's really going on in the world. Yes, that is, yeah, the epistle of James, yeah, named after the king for some reason, poor guy, you know. Yeah, when you actually look at it in Greek, it's Yaakov, so that's... Oh, the Septuagint?
Yes.
Yes, the Septuagint. It's yeah, it's kind of good too when you're reading it. You got like a Tanakh, so you got it in Hebrew, and you got it in Greek, and then you have it in English, so you can sort of see where things go, and you can also see what the apostles. Because the apostles quoted from the Septuagint extensively.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because when you compare, like, you know, you'll see like one of the big things that that there were some There were some in the Middle Ages who brought up charges of gross misquoting of the Tanakh in the New Testament. Well, the point was that the quotations are nearly identical to what they are in the Septuagint, not called the Masoretic text, which is the standard Hebrew text that we have today. But in some of those key places, especially in Messianic prophecies, there's far more congruence in some of the key issues between the Septuagint and the Dead Sea Scrolls, which predate the Masoretic text by, good grief, several hundred years. So, yeah, almost 1,000 years. So you see a lot more congruence. And so places where you see this big deviation from your standard Hebrew text in the Septuagint, you go and you compare that. If you can get your hands on there's some English translations of the Dead Sea Scrolls around, and you compare that. So it's kind of a fun one, but the Dead Sea Scrolls and some of the books are Swiss cheese. So there's not many remnants left, and it's a big jigsaw puzzle. But thankfully, if you're comparing stuff in the book of Yeshayahu or Isaiah, pretty much the whole thing's there. So yeah, so you can compare, you know, Septuagint to Dead Sea Scrolls to Masoretic text, and you'll start seeing that the apostles were not playing fast and loose with their quotations. So, that's right. Cool deal. You have a comment over here?
In the prior parasha, we read about how they were whining and crying, or maybe earlier.
Grumbling,
about
yes.
Lots
of grumbling.
About the leeks and onions and the fish and all of that. And in that context, I can't remember the Hebrew in it, but it basically brings out that they were desiring to want, to be in a state of want. So I believe it goes a little bit beyond just being faithless into actually a rejection of God, because he had already done these wonders and they're still saying, we want to go back. And what they would have been going back to would have been a life where they weren't provided for like God was providing for them in the wilderness.
Mm. Interesting. Any other thoughts before we go further too much? Yes, we have a comment over.
I was just going to say, I think of the difference between faith and trust as faith is something you think you know, but trust is when you know right and you don't know.
Faith versus trust, yeah. Yeah, but, you know, again, it's one of those things of maybe a better way to put it is, you know, belief versus trust.
You said about the demons. They believe.
Yes.
They tremble.
Yes.
One of the things I noticed, and I'm wondering if you have any connection with it, is that Caleb and Joshua from Judah and Ephraim, who later on become the two sticks combined in Ezekiel.
Yeah, they become basically the leaders to put everything back together again. So, very interesting, isn't that?
Yeah.
That you have those two houses become leaders. They go their separate ways kind of later on in the history of Israel, between north and south. But eventually, you know, the prophecy is that they become the, you could say, the anchors to bring everything back together. And not just the ones that were lost, but love that in the two-stick prophecy where it talks about, and their associates. You know, you've got Israel and their associates, and then you've got Yehuda and their associates. People that are connected to them in both ways. You see, that is a great fulfillment of those who are far off being brought near. And we saw that in mentioning in chapter 15 here in Numbers, where they talked about that there will be one law for the sojourner and for the native born. Mentions that a few times in here. The idea is that you would want those who have some sort of casual, either those that came out of Mitzrayim in this case, or those later on who end up settling in the land, that they would want to not just occupy space, but also become really part of the society and get to know God. So that's really a beautiful prophecy. Yeah, we have a question over here.
Oh, I was just going to say that I think faith is whether if you believe you're worth it or not. And I think
You're worth it. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, and I think it's a paradox because, you know, as humans, we still struggle with sin. And I think the only exception to that rule, if, you know, you're hopelessly in love with your sin.
Hmm. Hmm. Hopelessly in love with your sin. Oh. Yes.
And that, you know, that refers to people who...
God doesn't listen to
sin. Obstinately love their sin, yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, basically, who are you really wanting to attach yourself to? And that's kind of what Numbers 15 and really these chapters here are talking about. Who is it that you want to follow? Yeah, we have a comment back here.
I kind of... have to disagree in a little way. Sometimes you're addicted to things, and when you started something, like for me, when I was a young girl smoking cigarettes, I had no idea they were addictive, and it became a love-hate thing. And then, I mean, I don't smoke now, but it was, I really had trouble quitting. It took me a long time, and I didn't love it, but I don't even know how to explain that. But I had to quit it. But sometimes people don't love their sin. They are addicted, and it's not really a love thing. It's a horrible addiction.
Yeah, there's one of those great, great yet disgusting illustrations of it. It's like a dog returning to his own vomit. And you're like, oh my, yuck. But it's one of those things of an illustration that you go back to it maybe by instinct, yet you don't realize how disgusting it really is. And see, we throw in the same way we talk about like chemical addiction, but you know, really all of them are chemical addictions to some degree, is shooting off one little sort of pleasure thing in your head or another. But the question is, what do you do about those responses? At some point, we all have to come up with a decision. What are we going to do with this response? Even though we get a pleasure response, are we going to step back from it and go, yuck, that's vomit? And each of us, you know, when one of the things I was envisioned with, one of the great things that the Spirit of God does is it helps you step back and look at your situation with a little bit more perspective. And when you kind of step back from it a little bit and you look at it, I know in my life, I can start seeing, yeah, that's vomit. That's vomit. Don't want to go there again. But it's like one of those, the misery, you love to wallow in your misery, even though you know it's miserable, but it's a... pleasant, it's a familiar misery. Familiar misery, yes.
I have to say, for those who defiantly love their sin, that's what I meant.
Defiantly love their sin.
Yeah, defiantly, not hopelessly.
And,
yes.
And now you're getting really...
Who know that it's wrong and they keep on doing it.
Yes.
Know, despite what somebody tells them. Hopelessly is like, you know, well, yeah, I love it, but I don't have the power to overcome it, you know.
Yeah.
I think God can still help people out like that, but
well, you know,
he doesn't listen to those who defiantly, you know, love their sin.
And one of the great lessons that we have from Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, is that, I mean, better called Kippurim because it's covering many different levels of sin, and the things that talks about there are sins, transgressions, and iniquities. You know, in modern times, you might think, oh, those are just, you know, synonyms for each other. No, they're not. They're basically, how much far away from God are you moving? You know, sins, you know, we talked about this before, it's like you're aiming for a target and you miss. Okay, you wanted to hit the target, and yeah, the target is good thing, so you miss. Transgressions, you're more willful stuff going on. You basically know what you're doing, and you decide to do differently. As we've mentioned before, the Apostle Paul kind of really nails that when he says, you know, being dragged away and enticed. So you're dragged away, you kind of know where you're supposed to be, but you're dragged away and enticed. Iniquities, a good way to put that is either rebellion, or some people find it better to define that as treason. Where you are, that is just outright disloyalty. You know, that is, and now you can understand why it is often compared to adultery. When you see the prophets talk about this, and even we've seen here in the Torah sometimes, it's mentioned as adultery. Because that is a huge break in loyalty that you were having with the one who brought you. Yes. Oh, well, one of the things, you know, we can look at the apostolic scripture, and it just says sin, 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 sin. But, and you look at the, back in the Torah, you'll notice that you'll start seeing sins, transgressions, and iniquities, and not the same words, not just alternate words for the same meaning. They are basically increasing degrees of moving away from God, moving away from God. So that's why when you see like a Numbers 15, it's like unintentional, unintentional, unintentional. Those are kind of like in the sins and transgressions categories, the unintentional. But when you start seeing in the defiant category, that's iniquity. But one of the great things that you see, especially with the prophets, like after the exile, is it talks about, and we saw that just a parasha or two ago when we were looking at one of the prophets, and they mentioned about healing iniquities. Healing iniquities. That is an utter, outright affront. That is what the book of Hosea is about. It's about someone in outright treason, outright adultery against their other. And what happens in that? Well, you could say needing healing, getting sick, but one of those cases is you finally get to the point where you and, you know, that wife, and, you know, say his wife, what happens to her finally? She's gone far, far, far away. What happens? Hosea's wife. What happens when she, the farthest she goes away? Gets sold into slavery. Boy, does that sound like the exiles. Yes, it does. And indeed it does. In fact, it should not only remind you of the exiles, it should remind you of Mitzrayim, Egypt. It should remind you of that. And what happened with Egypt? We talked about that during Passover time. Israel was purchased out of Egypt at great cost to Egypt. And that reminder continued on with the whole thing of dedicating the firstborn. That should never be forgotten at the huge cost. So thus, the death of the firstborn was the main thing that freed the people. So thus, with the great Passover, with Yeshua, the death of the firstborn brought the freedom.
So,
yes, purchased by the firstborn. So that's one of those great recurring lessons over and over and over again. It never gets old because... Yes. Yes. That's why that the whole thing when it talks about the only begotten Son, the only begotten Son, that's what the huge importance of that means. And another way to put that, you know, the firstborn of God. So that's kind of what brings us around to this picture that we're seeing in these chapters. So I guess starting out first, when we look at this, we see that we have these spies, and as they noted, they came from every single one of them. It said to basically send a leader up, send a president up to go into the land. Now, why was it so important that you would have one from each tribe go up? Can they just send up one, two, get your two witnesses, send two in, and that would be just fine? Wouldn't that be just good enough? Why not? A spokesman from each tribe? Someone from all the tribes? Yes.
You asked why. I'm going to say that they were all going to take the land together. It was a land for all of them.
Yeah, and they were going to each settle a part of that. So it's like all of them had to go up and see what the situation was like. They all had to go up and see what the situation. Now, we were talking about Hosea. Well, there's a specific, another Hosea shows up here. Well, the name Hoshea shows up. And the son of Nun. And Moshe called him Yehoshua. Now, with Hosea, you get two pictures with both of these names. The first one of which was Hosea comes from Yasha, about living in abundance, living in a place that's wide open. So you get this idea of you're going from a place that may not have enough to a place that's got a lot. So quite appropriate that he's the one who leads them where? Into the land flowing with milk and honey and all the good stuff. All the good stuff that they go to see. So one of the things that we see is, yes, he fills this role of the salvation or deliverer. But then you see he takes on another name with Yehoshua. So you get the addition of the short form of the name of Yahweh. And with Yah, so you have Yah is salvation. Or Yah is the one who delivers you out. So one of the things that we see in this is that he is not just a deliverer, but who is delivering? Is it this guy? Or is it the one who is behind this guy, the one who fights for them? Yeah, he's going into battle. Yeah, he's leading an army. But what makes the difference with the army? You could say your tactical, your strategic advantage. Well, your strategic advantage is to have the creator of heaven and earth with you. The one who made everything, the one who gives life to everybody, is the one who goes with you. So that huge advantage that you have there. So we see some other extensions of that with Yeshua, which is where we get the shortened form of Yeshua. And also a picture, you see this throughout the Psalms about bringing salvation in. But one of the things that we see is that this salvation that Yeshua is bringing, and the salvation that we see is the forerunner with Yehoshua bringing, is what? Is it just in the present? Or is it in the future? And continuing on. Because that's the one picture that we see, is just getting into the land is not enough. Just getting in the front door of the land, not enough. Because if you just have salvation in without the one who truly can bring salvation, without Yah going with you, are you truly free? Yeah, you just brought your, quote, shackles with you into a new location. Those shackles, we just were talking about this attraction to go back to where we were at before. You know, forgetting about how bad it was, forgetting how unsightly it was. So one of these things that we see about when they go in and they, you probably have seen lots of drawings and pictures of this gigantic cluster of grapes that they come back with, these huge things. So you see, everything is bigger and better. there in the land. You know, the walls are taller, the people are taller, the grapes are enormous. Everything is big as it goes into the land. So thus they call this the Valley of the Cluster. And as we see kind of later on, people reflect on this and see that this picture of these giant grapes is kind of like, and you'll see this in some of the prophets too, where they talk about the Lord kind of staining his robes get stained in the blood of grapes. So, and you might start getting your wheels turning here about the book of Revelation, where it talks about that his robes were stained. Not any sort of coincidental comment on this. This is directly pointing back to the prophetic time of what they're talking about in the Messianic era, that there would be this deliverance that would come in. And, you know, another comment that comes through that in the world to come, the Holy One, blessed be He, will make a banquet for the righteous in the Garden of Eden, and He will give them to drink wine preserved in its grapes since the 6 days of creation. So, one of these pictures that we see is, and we'll be seeing this in a connection that is directly made to this particular incident. We've mentioned it in times before in Hebrews 3 and 4. Well, Hebrews 3 and 4 also point specifically, and it makes entering my rest, mentioned again in Psalm 95. But then that section ends there as chapter 4 of Hebrews is getting going, where it talks about now there remains a Sabbath rest for all believers. And he keeps talking about entering the rest being the land. And you see this then compare, well, there remains a Sabbath rest for all believers. Then it launches in from chapter 4 down through chapter 10 about who is this ultimate rest. And that ultimate rest comes through the great high priest. The great high priest that we have, who's on duty at all times, has been on duty, continues to be on duty, to, again, cover our sins, transgressions, and iniquities. So this picture, what we're seeing here, going into the land, is something that shows up a lot of times throughout Israel's history, and you see it in the apostolic era as well. Now, one of the things that I hope you all got a chance to, if you ever see what they call the Haftarah portions, Haftarah just basically a basic translation is, roughly translate that as like a, I wouldn't say a tangent, but you could say parallel connected to reading of it. And for this particular week, it's Joshua chapter 2. So, Joshua chapter 2, and kind of keep things short, but we've talked about this before with Joshua chapter 2. It's what? It's the two spies. So you compare then what we have in our parasha that we're looking at here. We have got 12 spies that go in. In the case of Joshua chapter 2, we got two spies that go in. Now, what are some key differences you see between those two incidents? You got the 12 spies that go into the land, and then you've got these two spies that go into specifically one particular place, and that's Jericho or Jericho. What are some differences that you see in there? And you're kind of like look at there in Numbers, and then kind of looking at Joshua 2. What are some similarities and differences? Okay, you could say spies. Spies go into both places. But what then do they see? Yes. Yeah. Comment over here.
I did read it, and I think they were, well, they got caught, sort of. Somebody saw them.
Yep.
And they had to be hidden.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that means anything, but she was only bound by an oath as long as she did what she said she would do. She said she would hide them and not make them known. Otherwise, they were not obligated to protect her. And then she had to have her whole family in that house. And if nobody was in that, whoever was not present in that home was not under protection. So there were specifications with the spies.
Okay. An oath. And we were talking about this just a little bit ago when we were talking about oaths. Well, what is an oath? Like a vow and vows. Oaths and vows. Well, they're promises. Promises and relating to something that you could say, you could, somebody is overseeing it. So that's why one of those key warnings about making the oaths is, you know, who are you dragging into this conversation? Well, who was it that was, you could say, a party to this oath that was made to Rahab? Well, her family. But who then was actually going to do something to the place where she lived? The Lord was the one who actually took down the city. The people, you might remember, were just they would eventually be marching just around it. They didn't actually go in. They didn't knock down the walls. Those walls were very big. You know, if you ever seen any pictures of the excavation of Jericho, those walls were enormous. Not going to just knock those things down. And they had multiple walls. Yes, they were huge, gigantic walls that you could not bash down. So when you see what actually happened to it, that those walls kind of fell down, and they just were basically taken down by great force, well, yeah, that just shows you how your fortifications will stand up to the creator of heaven and earth. They just won't. They won't. You know, you think you're going to keep out the Lord by using the dirt that the Lord made. Kind of goes back to that old joke, you know. Go get your own dirt. Yeah. If you want to try to create something, well, you're going to try to defend yourself against the maker of heaven and earth by using giant earthworks. Not going to work too well. So one of the key things that you see there, you got two, the spies go in. You've got 10 of these. Give a 1-star rating. Maybe if they could give a no star rating, they would. And then you've got 2 of them that, you know, give like the 5-star rating. These are fantastic. So, you know, today we do lots of things, you know, especially if you like or see like online shopping or something like that. We go a lot by recommendations. Is it worth it? And you look at the reviews on it. Is it worth it? And you start wondering if you see a lot of 1-stars on things. And then you look at what they say about it. And you think, well, is this credible? Is it not credible? Well, when you're thinking about back in the ancient setting, the people are coming back and they've got 10 people giving this 1-star reviews of going into the land. This is the land that we've been working toward and marching toward and stuff like that. And here you've got 10, you know, average people. No, these were leaders. These were leaders of the tribes that they were coming from. These were people with credibility. And they were saying, there's no way. Absolutely no way that we could do this. No way we go into the land. This land is going to be a death trap. Not just for us, but our whole generations will be wiped out. Our line will be gone. This whole endeavor of Israel will be wiped out. And then you've got 2 that are saying, what? The Lord is with us. The Lord is with us. And what came of the report of the 10? They're like, fear went rampant. So one of those things when you talk about the good report and the bad report that comes in is like, that just goes to show you that to be extremely careful that we have to be about either if we have influence on people, that we bring a bad report about things that God is doing, or if we are around people that are bringing a bad report about something that God is doing. You know, and something that we can nudge and kind of help help our brothers and sisters in the body of Messiah by, you know, if you have the, A common thing that you'll hear today is that, well, you know, that's the God of the Old Testament. It's like, well, are we starting to get into the giving the one-star review? You know, Old Testament God gets the one-star review. New Testament God, he gets the five-star review. It should be a little bit of a historical warning about when you start taking things that God said, hey, this is the place where I'm taking you, this is the thing that I'm doing, and then you start wanting to give it a one-star review, and then convince others, yeah, this is really, it's bad. It's a bad notion. But her, on the other hand, what is Rahab's reaction? We have heard reports. We have heard reports.
Well, they're right in the middle of the
right in the middle of the wilderness,
they
yeah.
They see the smoke, they see the fire, they see the people following, they saw the ocean, they said they saw and heard about all these things that Heavenly Father has done there.
Yes, well, also remember that who was it that died in the sea? The Egyptian army. Now, if you kind of remember your history books a little bit, or watching his history programs, they'll talk about ancient Egypt was always doing what in the land of Canaan? Raiding. Lots. There's like all kinds of monuments and stuff in ancient Egypt about all the military battles and stuff Roman Empire, the Egyptian Empire was doing in Canaan. So to then hear the people in Canaan hearing that, wow, the army that's been doing all these raids and stuff into their territory just got wiped out by these slaves, by these campers on a caravan, that is like, wow. Yes, we have a comment down here.
Well, they say they wanted to go back to Egypt. Wasn't Egypt pretty much wiped out? I mean,
it was in bad, bad shape.
I mean, maybe
two or three dozen
maybe people left or something.
Well, I don't know about two or three dozen people, yeah. But one of those things that that they're starting to, there's been some conferences recently where some scholars have gotten together and talked a lot about some Egyptian accounts. And there are a number of Egyptian accounts that start talking about some horrific disasters that came upon Egypt. And one of those in particular was talking about, I always remember his name. His name is Ipuwer. Ipuwer, if you go and you want to go to do a search, look up Ipuwer and Egypt's Chronicles and then read it. And it's like, oh my goodness, you start hearing what sounds like a firsthand account of the plagues of Egypt. And he talks about the destruction. There's hardly anybody left. The whole place is in disarray. Because, you know, one of the things to also look about ancient Egypt was that the pharaoh was basically keeping the hordes at bay. There were a lot of kings that operated in Egypt from time to time. And they would have multiple ones at the same time, and they'd be fighting each other for territory. So one of the things that the famine and Yosef's administration did was it consolidated power under one king in Egypt. One pharaoh then dominated all of them. All of them basically became the people, as you saw in Genesis, they became like slaves or servants to Pharaoh because of that. That consolidated all the power under one. And then the Lord not only consolidated, you know, remember that thing where he keeps saying, I put up kings and I take them down? He put up that one particular king. And then one of his descendants took him down, took down that power and the sea. So when the people, their nemesis there in Canaan, heard about this, wow, this great power was taken down. So when you say about faith, you see examples of faith in this, but the amazing thing is that This is kind of a sad story. It's almost, this account you see in Joshua chapter 2 is almost a lot like the book of Jonah, or Jonah, where it's a sad testament that this foreign people will actually trust more about what God's capabilities are than the native people back home. That's one of the sad pictures that you have in this, is that out of those 10 spies that we're reading about here today, only two of them really had enough trust in the power of the Lord to actually make this happen. And in Joshua chapter 2, a foreigner has great trust to actually rebel, doing iniquity against her own people, against the place where she was living, to decide to go off and join a different group and attach herself to a different group. One of the... Yes. And same thing with Ruth. When she went from Moab, which we could say is ancient descendants, you know, son, related to Abraham, yet decided to leave. And we see throughout history that Moab was a nemesis against Israel for quite a long period of time. But in these two accounts we're seeing here, we see, you could say, almost harlotry. And in that one, she's described as, in various ways, as a zonah or a harlot. But the sad thing, just like with the foreign people, had more trust rather than the typical no associations, no breaking of loyalties that the prostitution is known for. She decides to put her loyalty with and attach herself with great loyalty to the Lord, the God of Israel. Versus the 10 spies then lead a whole group of people into harlotry, into iniquity, into treason against the one who took them that far and took them out of Mitzrayim, across the sea, and took them through the points where they had no water, the points where they had no food, helped them survive these sneak attacks from Amalek, took them through and finally brought them up to the land. So one of the things that we also see, and kind of some similarities with this, is with the spying out of the land, there's also some other, you could say, spying out sort of, I thought that was kind of interesting, was Yeshua had 12 spies, you say. Remember when he sent them out two by two into different places, go throughout, you know, the people of Israel in the land, and, you know, heal the sick, raise the dead, cast out demons and such. This was a point where Yeshua was sending these 12 out. And one of the things that we see in this picture of sending out the 12, in a sense, it was really going to some of the strongholds. You know, you're going up against these cities that were... What were some of the strongholds that the 12 spies of Yeshua were encountering when they went out throughout the land? Where are some of those strongholds? Who is the Mashiach? Because who are they going in the name of? Throwing out, casting out demons in my name. They were going out under the name, the authority of that. So they're basically, everywhere they're going, that is encountering that. What is going to be their reception? Are they going to encounter like those 10 spies sort of reaction? Or are they going to encounter the Rahab sort of reaction? that, wow, yes, God is working through this Yeshua that you were teaching us about. Yes, this is what the prophets were pointing forward to. So yes, this is a work that God is doing, and we're going to perhaps go from what we have been hearing about who the Mashiach, what type of person the Mashiach would be, to the Mashiach is here. The kingdom of God is here. And you can see some of their calling cards. And their calling cards are what? Call them just in general miracles. Yeah, basically power of God in action. This is restoring the blind, because that was one of the things that you see a prophecy of, that this would be a hallmark of the Messianic era, would be the healing of the blind. And the lame will leap like deer. So basically the Creator is at work. The one who has the power over sickness, the one who created everything, can recreate everything. So that is one interesting picture that we have of this spying out of the land by the 12 as they were going out. Is an occasion that's recorded in a few places in Matthew 17 and Mark 9 and Luke 9. So, yeah, Matthew 17. Mark 9. I think I said Luke 9, right? I think I did. Yes. So one of these cases is the recording of the time where some of these students, some of these disciples, are trying to throw out a demon. A demon-possessed man was brought to the disciples. It doesn't mention about the disciples were not able to do it, because that was the complaint. So they came to Yeshua and they said, well, we took them to your students and they couldn't do anything about it. Couldn't do anything about this situation. So one of the kind of the fuller context of this we'll take a look at here is actually in fuller context in Mark 8. So Mark 8, starting in verse 34, and we'll go through verse 29 of chapter 9. So Mark 8, 34, 9, 29. So kind of the fuller context of this. Because this directly relates to what we're seeing recorded here, again, first off with Numbers 13 through 15. So, I'm going to say Mark 8. Yeah, see Mark 8 and... yes. Start in verse 34. So this is kind of... there have been some of these warnings that you'll see recorded earlier in chapter 8. But this is kind of zeroing it down into a particular account. It's often called like the Mount of Transfiguration. But it also sets up this encounter that the disciples were having with dealing with a demon-possessed man. So after he summoned the crowd with his disciples, he said to them, "If anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake and for the good news of the kingdom will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of him when he comes in the glory of his Father with his holy angels. And Yeshua was saying to them, "Truly I say to you, there are some of those who are standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God after it has come with power." 6 days later, Yeshua took with him Peter and Yaakov and Yochanan and brought them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His garments became radiant and exceedingly white, as no launderer on earth could whiten them. And Eliyahu appeared to them, along with Moshe, and they were talking with Yeshua. Peter said to Yeshua, "Rabbi, it's good for us to be here. Let us make three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moshe, and one for Eliyahu." For he did not know what to answer, for they became terrified. Then a cloud formed, overshadowing them, and a voice came out of the cloud, "This is my beloved son. Listen to him." All at once, they looked around and saw no one with them anymore, except Yeshua alone. As they were coming down from the mountain, he gave them orders not to relate to anyone what they had seen until the Son of Man rose from the dead. They seized on that statement, discussing with one another what rising of the dead meant. They asked him, saying, "Why is it that the scribes say that Eliyahu must come first?" He said to them, "Eliyahu does come first and restore all things. Yet, how it is written of the Son of Man that he will suffer many things and be treated with contempt? But I say to you that Eliyahu is indeed come, and they did to him whatever they wished, just as it is written of him." When they came back to the students, they saw a large crowd of them and some scribes arguing with them. Immediately, the entire crowd saw him, and they were amazed and began running up to greet him. And he asked them, "What are you discussing with them?" And one of the crowd answered him, "Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it slams him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth, and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. I told your disciples to cast it out, but they could not do it." And he answered them and said, "O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me." They brought the boy to him, and when he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling around and foaming at the mouth. He asked his father, "How long has this been happening to him?" He said, "From childhood. It has often thrown him both into the fire and onto the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us." And Yeshua said to him, "If you can, all things are possible to him who believes." Immediately the boy's father cried out and said, "I do believe. Help my unbelief." When Yeshua saw that a crowd was rapidly gathering, he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You deaf and mute spirit, I command you to come out of him and do not enter him again." After crying out and throwing him into terrible convulsions, it came out. The boy became so much like a corpse that most of them said, "He's dead." But Yeshua took him by the hand and raised him up, and he got up. When he came into the house, the disciples began questioning him privately, "Why could we not drive it out?" He said to them, "This kind cannot come out by anything but prayer." Yeah, well, some of these accounts have prayer and fasting, like the passage in Mark of Matthew chapter 17. And I was kind of curious about that because the New American Standard put those in square brackets, like it's in one of those cases where, well, it's an insertion. It's not in some text. So I was looking it up in the Comfort textual commentary, which is basically it analyzes all the different variations that you see throughout the apostolic writings, and when it explains why you'll see some variations from what the King James might translate it as and what you'll see a modern translation translate it as. And in this particular case, they note that none of the very earliest of the manuscripts that we have of Mark and Matthew and such have that, you know, and prayer and fasting, especially not in Matthew. So that's why some of those more modern translations will put that in parentheses or brackets or something. So, But it's one of these cases where we are presented with an example of the power of God in action. And the students of the Messiah are presented with the power of God in action. So what do you see as this connection? We're starting out with, first you're talking about this Mount of Transfiguration, and then you're also seeing this with this discussion about the healing of this guy with this demon involved. Okay. Yes, do you have a question?
Okay, so there's another instance where... and don't, you probably will remember, but they were praying. May I hold up? The people were trying to get a demon out of somebody, but they couldn't do it, and the demons came back on them because I felt like because they didn't believe in Messiah.
Oh, is this talking about in the Book of Acts? Yeah.
I figured you'd know where it was, but I remember that. So they didn't even have the faith. So if you don't have the faith and belief,
that was kind of an interesting situation where the demon voiced it through the man. It was something very interesting. He said, because they were basically saying, by the name of Yeshua who Paul preaches, come out of him. And the demon voiced through the guy and said, well, I know Peter and I know Yeshua. I don't know who you are. So, yeah, basically, it's like very, very similar to these people going, well, let's go up into the land. Well, you go up into a place with very strongholds, those high walls and the tall people you were afraid of. So it's amazing how they suddenly lost their fear of the tall walls and the giants when they just decided to go up after they were basically told, okay, your generation's going to die. So then they decided to go up anyway. Well... if you're going up against those strongholds, you need to have the secret weapon. And that secret weapon, the one that will break down every stronghold, any sort of obstacle you're going to face, is if that the Lord wills it to be done, it will be done. Yes, we have a comment down here.
After reading this again and just kind of hearing it out loud, for the first time, I've come to the realization that when he says, like in verse 19, he says, oh, faithless generation, how long am I going to be with you? How long am I going to bear with you? And then later on, just from there on, I had always read this thinking that he was kind of rebuking or chiding his disciples. It's basically, what's wrong with you? You know, but the faithlessness here, or the lack of faith that is at issue here, isn't the faith of the disciples. It's the faith of the man that brought the son to the disciples. He didn't have enough faith for the disciple that he believed the disciples could heal the boy, so that's why the disciples couldn't heal that boy. It was because of the father's lack of faith that boy wasn't healed when the disciples prayed over him or laid hands on him. It wasn't because of the disciples' lack of faith. It was because of the father's lack of faith. But it was only when Yeshua kind of broke through to him and he was able to say, help my unbelief, that finally that faith came in and Yeshua was able then to heal the boy.
A placebo? To basically break through the placebo effect. Believing makes action. Yeah. One of the things that may go a little bit beyond the placebo effect is if, it is not, you could say, humanly possible to do something. And in the case of, when you were going up against, in this case, with the going into the land with a much outsized opposition, higher walls, you don't have battering rams and advanced equipment and such, you're kind of in a total loss to deal with it. You have come to your wit's end. You can use your wit to get through the situation, but what happens when you get to the end of your ability to do something? And recognizing that what you're trying to undertake is actually beyond your possibility of doing it. So that is the kind of moving beyond the placebo effect. Although that's one of the nice things that the Lord has actually built into us is with the ability to heal ourselves. and also the power of your attitude and your mind to change your actual health. You know, we talk about in modern times about stress killing people. Well, it does. Stress kills a whole lot of people. And you're wondering, well, you're doing nothing but just thinking about something. Yeah, you watch what you're thinking. It can actually kill you. It is kind of an interesting thing, but that is, you could say, a slow killer. But we don't realize how our thoughts, if we don't take our thoughts under control and submit them to the law of the Messiah, that they can quickly get out of control and take us into a place that is actually deadly. But in one case of helping our unbelief, that realizing that you are at the extent of your ability to actually do something and then doing it anyway. And we just have gone through Memorial Day and kind of commemorating all the people who have died in the various wars and such. And, you know, just gone through D-Day also. And if you've ever read any of those accounts, and maybe you've seen some movies where they tried to recreate what D-Day was like, but imagine that. Imagine going up against something that just looks absolutely hopeless, but moving forward anyway. That is an amazing sort of a break with yourself. And one of the things that we're looking at with this, and you know, Tammy, I'm glad you brought that up, is about the lack of belief in the people who are actually brought this man to Yeshua. Because one of those things, did that ring a bell with you, what Yeshua said to them? Oh, this faithless and wicked generation. What was it that the Lord said in chapter 14 of Numbers? What did he say back there? Chapter 14 of Numbers. Yes. Yep. Don't believe me. They're not believing me. Let's see, where is that? Oh, yes. In chapter 14, verse 11. The Lord said to Moshe, "How long will this people spurn me? And how long will they not believe in me, despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst?" So with this picture that we have of the great work that Yeshua is doing in the midst of people, and where are they putting their trust? They want just more and more and more signs. Putting your trust in fear, being afraid of something, so not going forward and doing it. The cost, in other words, the cost is too high. Because one of those things about the cost being too high is we see in the greatest commandments, you know, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. Especially that soul part we've talked about in the past about with all of your nefesh, with all of that. All of that makes you alive. That wind that blows within you that makes you alive. All of that too. So in other words, he was telling these people as they were getting ready to encounter the land and go in, yeah, the walls are tall. Yeah, the people are tall. And they're strong. And they've got armaments and stuff. You don't have much of anything. But are you going to go anyway because of the trust that you have in the one who's behind you? That is one of the great lessons that we can have not only in this passage, but in these other passages, because it gets down to where we are in chapter 15, and it talks about chapter 15 of Numbers, and it mentions the drink offering, the drink offering, the drink offering. We've talked about the various symbols that you get from the offerings. We went through Leviticus on that and what the offerings do. They take the person coming from the outside, you're coming from far off from the presence of God, and you're being brought near to the presence of God. But you can't just come in as you are. You have to be transformed from the person you were before into someone who has been covered for all your sins, transgressions, and iniquities, and then you are brought into the presence of God, a different person changed. So with this, yes. Though your sins be as scarlet, they shall be as white as snow. Yeah, what you're referring to is in Hebrews chapter 10. You know, and if you basically turn away from Yeshua, there is no more sacrifice for you. Because as you get in chapter 10 of Hebrews, it starts out talking about Day of Atonement. Talks about the Day of Atonement near the beginning, and it even quotes again another quotation from the New Covenant prophecy in Jeremiah 31. But one of the unique things about the Day of Atonement is covering of sins, transgressions, and iniquities. Because what is one of the things that we were going through Leviticus, and you even see there in Numbers chapter 15, what are these things covering outside of the Day of Atonement? Unintentional sins. It keeps, you see that mentioned, unintentional, unintentional, unintentional. But you see in the Day of Atonement, sins, transgressions, and iniquities. One of the great lessons is that even the outright rebellion and such, that He will even heal even that. Even unbelievable affronts to the name of God. And it mentions there, blaspheming. That you're... Blasphemy means to basically take something that is holy, take something that is separate, something that's very special and precious, making it common, making it of no effect. That's behind one of the Ten Commandments when it says, do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Or another way to put that is, do not take the name of the Lord and make it of no effect or nothing special. So that's when you see in the prophets and it says, my name is blasphemed among the nations. My name has been brought low. It's been made common. In some cases, less than common. Than something that's actually derogatory. It's been dragged down. Not only sapped of anything special, but made, you can almost say, a curse word. And today, even say, when we think of that commandment, we think of it only as a curse word. Because, yeah, it even has become a curse word. Not only just making it nothing special by... devoiding of any sort of special meaning, but also then bringing it into a curse. So that is a great picture that we have of where the Lord is taking us. So we see in Numbers 13, we see in Numbers 14, it's all about this is the place where the Lord is taking you. He took you out of Mitzrayim. You were in the house of bondage. You know, He delivered you in the sea. He fed you. He gave you water to drink. Told you who He was. So you're not just kind of having to guess by some, you know, priest kind of spouting stuff off every now and then, and you never know who it is that you're actually serving. Yeah, we have a comment down here. So He did all these things, and now it's like bringing you to the point of this is the place where you are going to live. Yes?
How do you balance out, you know, blaspheme? Moses didn't think he was that special, isn't that right? I mean, he was humble. He had a lot of humility. He didn't like attention, but God, you know, he was holy. Are you saying, like, you know, if somebody else told, hey, Moses, you know, Moses, you're not special, then that's like blaspheme? But,
well, you know, one of the things that when you think of treating as special, as holy, you know, one of the things you might say with Moshe, and he's described as being the most humble man who walked the face of the earth, as at one point he's talked about. But one of those great characteristics is he knew who he was, but he knew where the source of power and the source of leadership came from. And that was from the Lord. The one place where he was faulted, and that ultimately kept him from entering the land, was, you know, that encounter at the rock. But one of those things that he it was faulted for, because he hit the rock and he said, you know, you rebels, you know, how? Basically the point is, how am I going to take you into the land? Well, the Lord then chastises him and says, because you did not treat me as sacred or holy. You didn't treat me as special. Thus, you're not going in. You forgot who it was who's actually doing all this stuff. Yeah, the burden is physically on you. All the people are harassing you all the time. They're trying to form rebellions against you all the time. They're, even your own siblings are trying to form a rebellion against you and knock you down. But in all of this, you know, you have remembered who it was who was actually in charge. In this point, with that rock and getting the water out of the rock, he did not lift the Lord up as the Lord who was the one who was going to deliver them into the land. So that's kind of the sad point in that. You know, we see that in the case we were just looking here in Mark chapter 8 and 9, that okay, Moshe still lifted and held up as someone great. So even that little bit of swaying away from the point of his total, you could say, backing and underscoring of the Lord's authority, but he still was a great leader who pointed them to the source. Yeah, he did have that failing near the end of his life, but still lifted up as someone special. So one of the things that we see as we come down to the end of this lesson is that when the Lord is announcing his judgment that they're not going to enter the land, we talked about how those folks didn't like that judgment, so they decided to go up and take it anyway. And he said, you're not going in. This generation is going to die. And I encourage you to go and take a look at Hebrews chapter 3 and 4 and also Psalm 95, because Hebrews 3 and 4 quote a number of times from Psalm 95 about, I swore in my wrath, you will not enter my rest. And that rest, you know, being a specific reference to the land, that place where they would go and they would stop their journey from their, quote, creation as the great nation. Yeah, it started with Abraham, but it really meet its, quote, you could say, completion in the land. But they wouldn't go to that point of entering the land to be at their destination, because they didn't want to go where God was leading them. And like, okay, we're going to have to do a reboot on the nation, and the second generation is going to go in to the land. But one of the key things that you'll see in Hebrews 3 and 4, and Psalm 95 kind of harps on it too, and Psalm 95 is referring to the event back in Exodus 17 of Massah and Meribah. The key question was, is the Lord with us or not? That's the key thing. They were grumbling because they, what? Had no water. And the place where they were led to get water, the water was bitter. It was undrinkable. It was like, wait, you led us out in the desert, number one. And then number two, you're leading us to a place with deadly water. Is the Lord with us or not? Is the Lord with us or not? When they get into the passage we're looking at here in Numbers 13 and 14, it's really the same question all over again. Is the Lord with us or not? They heard the spies with their one-star ratings and they go, nope, he's not with us and we can't do it. So thus, let's go back. Yes?
They should have done what... Is it King Hezekiah that prayed and pretty much laid everything out? We need to do that. We need to, like also in Hebrews, which I was... Sometimes I get a verse and I just keep reading it. I'll write it down and I take it out and look at it. But it was, faith is the assured expectation of things hoped for but not yet seen. And I really, it took a long, I'm still thinking on that. It's like, it's something you have to keep reading. And I'm like, well, show me, what does that mean? It means that we don't look at what's in front of us all the time if it's negative, because God can change that around. We need to change the way we're thinking, and we need to take the thoughts captive. We need to say, well, Father, this and this and this is in the way, like what King Hezekiah did. And then he turned around and fixed it.
Yeah, and it's seeing what's in front of you, but deciding to go anyway. And that's the tough thing. I know I have a hard time with, you know, trying to bring up a topic that's uncomfortable. I have a really, really hard time doing that. So, no. It's just, you know, like when I'm talking to somebody, it's an uncomfortable subject that, yeah, it has to be brought up. Or if you're kind of in the midst of a discussion and, you know, you basically have to say, well, you have to bring up basically that the Lord's way is the better way to look at this to people that are probably going to be hostile to what you're saying. That is an extremely uncomfortable thing to me, but to move forward even in the face of, yeah, you're going to likely get beaten over the head, metaphorically and rhetorically, but you're going to get flogged for it. But will you move forward anyway? And that's what you'll see the Yeshua talked about a number of times. I am poured out, I am poured out, I am poured out. And Apostle Paul uses reference to like a drink offering as well. That I am poured out like a drink offering, I'm poured out like a drink offering. In those contexts of, I am facing a situation that is, you know, I'm facing persecution, I'm even facing death, but I'm still moving forward anyway. So when we're talking about all the parable of the tabernacle, one of the great things with the image that we get of the drink offering is that like life being poured out as a part of the offerings. And you see that mentioned by Yeshua picks up on that. Apostle Paul picks up on that. So that is a lesson for us too, is that in our moving from where we were before, outside the tabernacle, outside the presence of God, toward the presence of God, you know, it will cost us. Our old way, who we were, is going to have to go, is going to have to die. So the sad part is, you know, when you think of the move from Mitzrayim in bondage to the land, we all encounter that, as we talked about with Passover. Each one of us, when we are delivered out of where we were before, our own house of bondage, we are delivered out. We're delivered from our pursuing enemies and such that come after us. The things, our old way of life that comes after us. We are delivered from that. And we go up to the place where the Lord wants us to be. Our new way of life, our destination, our promised land. Do we actually go forward with it? You know, like Yeshua said, when we build this tower, our new way of life, are we counting the cost? And do we go up to the land and go, this is going to cost me too much, and then turn back from it? So when Paul is talking about, you know, flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, and that the spirit and the flesh are always at war with each other, in a sense, you know, our old flesh, the old way of life, has got to die in the desert. And the rebirth, our second generation, is what goes in. The old part that is trusting on ourselves is going to die on the journey toward our destination with God. So thus, when Hebrews 3 and 4, and it refers in chapter 4 to there exists a Shabbat rest for all believers. What is it that Shabbat is a memorial of? First off, of creation. First off, it's of creation. So God created, and then He stopped. He doesn't need to go on creating anything more. So thus, when we see in our journey toward making us someone new, when we get to that new birth, that new person who's been transformed, just like the offering coming from the gate of the tabernacle all the way into the presence of God, there is not something else that needs to be done. There is no more creating that needs to be done, which is why the long part of Hebrews is, you know, you don't need to keep doing the sacrifice on the cross, the meaning behind Yom Kippur. They don't need to do that with Yeshua every single year. That was once for all time. He brings you to the promised land. He brings you to the rest completely. But just like as Hebrews 10 kind of ends, don't shrink back from it. When He takes you to where you want to go, He covers over your sins, transgressions, iniquities. Don't start going back from this thinking, I'm going to do it myself. I've done it myself. Yeah, I'm going to get this new way of life myself. No, realize how it was that you got to your new way of life and then move forward from that. Yeah, you have a comment?
That putting off and putting on, putting off and putting on the new behaviors, there's like layers to those things I've noticed from me. Like something I put off, it comes back in another little way where I didn't realize what it was until I'm in the middle of doing something and I'm like, oh, that's part of pride. Because I'm like, what is that, God? Yeah. I don't know what that is. What am I doing? This doesn't feel right. And then He's showing me that's pride. I'm like, so there's like different levels of pride. There's different levels, just all kinds of things that it's like, to me, it's like a, He'll take something and I'll work on it for a while and I don't see that there's other layers until they start popping up, you know? So it's like a long drawn out process of constantly putting off the bad, getting rid of the old man, and then putting on the new person and saying, okay, that's what I'm supposed to be doing.
Yeah, which is why that psalm is so great about, you know, examine me and you know, see everything about me and then lead me on to the ways of everlasting. It's, do you actually want the God to reveal everything to you? And not all at once. But do you just want to go a little bit and stop and say, okay, I'm comfy right where I am? Or is it that you always want to be revealed? Keep learning. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, keep learning, keep moving forward, and keep having to get revealed, which is also why you're probably wondering, okay, you've got all these offerings and such mentioned in Numbers chapter 15. Then it throws in tzitzit. What on earth is the tzitzitot doing in Numbers 15 too? What is all that about? And then it goes about Shabbat. And if you are then going off and wanting to, you know, it says he was acting with a high hand, then, you know, that is seen as a great crime. What is it about with the tzitzitot? First of all, what does it say that the tzitzitot are for? To remind us of the things that he has taught. Why? We forget, but also forget who it was who actually brought us this far. You know, it should be a reminder of this is a journey, a part of our journey out from who we were before to where we are becoming. It is a part of that journey. Not is that, you know, we do it ourselves. We manage to find our way out of where we were before and find our way to the correct destination ourselves. Then you see also with this point of Shabbat. Remember we were just talking about Shabbat as it's mentioned in Hebrews 3 and 4. That Shabbat is a symbol, yes, of the creation, but it's also, you'll see it referred to also as, you know, keep the Shabbat because I am the one who sanctifies you. It mentions there in Exodus. And then it also talks about in Deuteronomy chapter 5 that keep the Shabbat because what? I'm the one who freed you from Egypt. So the creator, the one who got your life in motion, the recreator, you know, the one who sanctifies you, you know, the one who makes you different from where you were before. So Shabbat is another, it's a memorial of that. It's a memorial of your rebirth as well. And Shabbat is a memorial of your freedom from your old life. So that's rebirth. Ain't so great if you just go right back and put your old chains back on again. If you decide to run back to Egypt again. Because, you know, your new way of life is too scary. Which it can be extremely scary. And it is often very scary and intimidating, the new way of life. But do we go forward anyway? Do we go all in on it? Yes.
Well, I just, two things have kind of popped out for me. One is, you know, as far as moving forward in faith that God's going to do something, obviously we need to keep that in context of what's already in Scripture. You know, these people, God had already told them, I'm going to give you this land. You know, it's not like they decided, hey, I want to make $1 million in 10 years and decide and, you know, expected him to walk with them on that and make it happen. But another thing too is that, you know, sometimes the way things are described in the Bible, sometimes it can be kind of hard to figure out how to practically apply it to our lives nowadays in the way that we understand things. The thing about it is these 10 other spies, they were being realistic. That's what they were doing. They went and they looked, they saw huge people and were like, this is crazy. You know, they looked at a real tangible situation right in front of their faces. And how often do we do that? Now, they experienced fear, but did all of them say they were afraid? Possibly not. And do we say that we're afraid? Do we even recognize that about ourselves? You know, a lot of times we put it under the label of realistic, which is kind of even a self-deception. So, you know, as far as, I mean, I think it's important, but it's also important to, you know, realize that fear is something, it's kind of sneaky. You know, we don't always realize, in fact, probably more often than not, we're acting out of fear and don't realize that it's fear that's taking us where we're going. You know, so, you know, we always have to keep in mind, God had already promised them that he was going to do this. You know, so even though they thought they were being realistic by looking at the physical right in front of them, they weren't remembering the whole picture, which is probably at least one point where the tzitziot come in, because that's to remind you, he had already told them something. When they looked at the picture in front of them, they forgot that one very important point. And since he had already promised it to them, that was the part of the picture that Joshua and Caleb kept. So they knew that they were going to be okay and that God was going to bring it for them.
Yeah, that the promise was made and that the promise would be kept. Because, you know, you think about how many things that we do in life that are based on promises and our trust in those promises. And as someone told me a long time ago, you know, when I was having some troubles, you know, trusting in God, it's like, well, you trust this floor, don't you? You're five stories up in the air. Yet you don't seem to be having a problem that you're five stories up in the air. Because what? This floor is underneath you. And you seem to walk around and just fine. What about the stairs you go down? You know, you seem to trust those too. You know, do you know the person who designed those stairs and built those stairs? I have no idea who that is. But you go to the stairs and you trust it. Why? Because you've seen other people go up and down the stairs. You've seen other people walk around on the floor. And they seem to be okay, so you go forward with it. So when we are faced with these kinds of promises, the promises that God has, he's given them plenty of examples of, yeah, okay, I keep my promises and I will do this. And even if it's a promise, like it, kind of things that you see described in Hebrews chapter 11, these are promises that will be kept long after those people were gone. But they still went forward with it anyway, because they trusted the one who made that promise with them, that they would be, in some of those cases, that they would inherit a better kingdom. You talk about the city built without foundations. They were revealed to it, revealed portions of what that would be, But they didn't see all of it. But they trusted the one who gave them that promise that it would be done. So, when I talk about faith, there's a whole lot of it here in this foundation that we're reading here in the Torah in this particular section. So any last thoughts is just as we close out our discussion here today? Yeah. Glad we all made it through and with the massive amount of heat. So let's close in prayer. Father God, we thank you for giving us these examples that when you make promises, you will keep them. And Father, we thank you for the promise that you've made for us, that the good thing that you've started in us, you will bring forth to completion. We thank you for reminding us with the Shabbat of what it is that you're looking to do and giving us rest, giving us a place to go. Father, we thank you for the promises that you give us and for reminding us each day when we listen to you, that you will bring these to completion. We thank you for building our faith each day in the name of your Son, Yeshua. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L dot I-N-F-O, hallel.info.